Darien Gap is a wild and mountainous jungle that connects Colombia with Panama. Migrants, including tens of thousands of children, are risking their lives to cross it.
Parents really believe that at home, wherever home is, there is no hope of a good life for their children.
Also today, a Ukrainian rock star who claims his superpower is inspiring people. How Vyacheslav Varkachuk is coming up with ways to keep fellow Ukrainians motivated to fight.
We recorded a cover of a famous song, You Are So Beautiful. We spelled it like UA So Beautiful because UA, it's a sign of Ukraine.
Plus, a German museum where you take in the art with your eyes and nose.
Nutmeg, cloves, rosemary, cinnamon.
Pairing historic works of art with the aromas of the time. I'm Marco Werman. All that and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for joining us on this Wednesday. Africa's largest country has a new president-elect. Bola Tinubu will be Nigeria's next leader, extending his party's rule. Earlier today, he called his election an affirmation of our democratic existence.
From my heart, and truly from my heart, I say thank you very much.
The opposition, though, is calling the election rigged. Reporter Anu Adeoye is with the Financial Times in Nigeria's capital and gave us the backstory on Tinubu.
Bola Tinubu is Nigeria's new president-elect. He was former governor of Lagos State, which is Nigeria's commercial powerhouse, from 1999 to 2007. After he left office as governor in 2007, he became a political godfather, making sure that everyone who succeeded him as governor of Lagos was a protege of his, and is widely credited with forming the coalition that brought the ruling All Progressives Congress to power in 2015.
And what does his election say about the desires of Nigerians?
If we take at face value the results of this election as provided by the National Electoral Commission, I think people are in some way voting for continuity. The ruling All Progressives Congress has been in power since 2015, and they faced a really tough opposition this time. But, I mean, they managed to win plurality of votes in this election. So I think perhaps it's a signal that Nigerians want more of the same with a different twist.
What is the opposition pointing to as evidence that this vote was fraudulent?
I think you have to go back to the months and weeks before the election, when the Electoral Commission said that there would be automatic transmission of results from the polling unit. In practice, it's supposed to mean that across Nigeria's 177,000 polling units, the results would be automatically transmitted to a central and public server that everyone would be able to access and see the results. But that did not happen. The Electoral Commission apologized this week, saying that it was due to technical glitches in scaling their new technology to a nationwide exercise. But the opposition is pointing to the fact that the Electoral Commission did not stick to its promise to transmit results in real time. And they are saying that that lag between when the results came in and when they were uploaded gave the ruling party the time to tamper with the results.
So the leaders of opposition parties have suggested they will legally challenge the election results. What outlets do they have, practically speaking, to do that? What's that going to look like?
They can go to an election tribunal that is set up for the purpose of dealing with election-related disputes. And I think if they are not satisfied with that, they can go through Nigeria's legal process all the way to the country's Supreme Court.
If he survives the challenges, what is next for President-elect Tinubu? What are the most immediate issues he's going to face as president?
Take a peek. There's rampant insecurity that's troubling many Nigerians. The economy is pretty much in tatters. Inflation has been running in double digits since March of 2016. There's a decision to be made on whether Nigeria will keep paying very costly fuel subsidies. So there's a range of decisions and actions that the president-elect has to make when he's sworn into office on May 29.
Anu, in the past months, there have been record numbers of young voters organizing around this election and registering. There was a lot of energy and enthusiasm around third-party candidate Peter Obi, who seemed to tap into that young voting cohort. But now we're seeing that the election had a record low turnout. Why the discrepancy between pre-election energy and actual votes that were cast?
I think we have to have a lot of nuance to the question of turnout. The Electoral Commission had logistical problems. They didn't show up in certain places on time or did not show up at all. There were people who actually wanted to vote and were unable to vote. I think in the lead up to the elections as well, there were fuel and currency shortages that perhaps affected people's ability to maybe travel to vote. So I think I wouldn't just necessarily say that the turnout that we've seen is a result of apathy. I think it's a lot more complex than people just didn't want to come out to vote.
Anu Adeoye is the West Africa correspondent with the Financial Times. He's been speaking with us from Nigeria's capital, Abuja. Anu, thanks very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
In Iraq, the population of the capital, Baghdad, has skyrocketed over the past 20 years. One result, a housing crisis. There has been a construction push to try and address the problem, but real estate prices are out of reach for most Iraqis, making housing unaffordable in what's already an expensive city. From Baghdad, reporter Yasmin Mossaman has a story.
Construction workers here drill and pour concrete into what will become some of the many glitzy new apartment buildings being built across Baghdad.
Already this rental, it contains 49 buildings.
Lubna Hussein works in the sales department of this apartment complex. It's called Iraq Gate. She's showing me around the many yellow high-rise towers. Some are fully built and already have residents. Others are still going up.
This is old design. This is a new design from areas, apartments, balconies.
Baghdadis have historically preferred living in low-rise houses. But Hussein says private complexes like these promise a standard of living people can't get elsewhere in the city.
Safety, electricity, everything here.
These perks might not sound like a lot, but in a city trying to recover from years of instability, they go a long way.
Maybe for the future, everybody live in a vertical building.
So Baghdad will completely change?
Sure. Inshallah, like Dubai.
But Dubai living comes at a Dubai cost. And most of these apartments in Iraq Gate now resell for over $500,000. That's a sum well beyond the means of the average Iraqi. Iraq is considered a middle-income country by the World Bank because of its oil sales. But much of that money does not trickle down to the public because of rampant corruption. Most of the people I meet at Iraq Gate rent their apartments. They don't own them. That includes Raja Muhammad, who lives here with her son and family. The price is very high. Not everyone is able to live here, she says. Her family would buy their apartment if they could. Right now, the biggest problem in Iraq is housing, says Muhammad. The average Iraqi makes the equivalent of under $500 US a month. That's as a public employee for the government. The value of the Iraqi dinar has fluctuated in recent months, making renting, let alone buying an apartment here, a dream for most. In the working-class neighborhood of Iskan, spider webs of electricity cables crisscross between unpainted concrete homes. Housing prices have doubled, say residents Safa, Asabia, and Mulham Salim. Poor people are most impacted by this, says Asabia. His friend adds, they used to be able to buy 100 square meters, and now they can't even afford 30. He's referencing the tiny houses being illegally built on parceled-up land across the city. Some of this is to provide cheaper housing for relatives, but officials say it adds pressure on already scarce public services. Real estate agent Muhammad Awad says this is precisely the problem. It's excessive demand and a shortage of land, he says. Anything you want that is in high demand will have high prices. But officials and analysts say money laundering is also playing a role. Iraq's Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani last year acknowledged that laundered money is being funneled into the city's real estate market. And with most transactions made in cash, dirty money is easy to wash. Not too far away is Emirat Street, which literally means Prince's Street. A new type of Iraqi royalty lives here, in palatial villas flanked by regal palm trees. Prices start at $5 million and go up to as much as $14 to $15 million here for a house, says Awad. In November, auditors uncovered that prominent businessmen and officials embezzled $2.5 billion in public taxes. Some of that money is said to have been laundered through purchasing properties here on Emirat Street. And with large sums of money being pumped into housing, prices go up for everyone. For The World, I'm Yasmin Mossiman in Baghdad.
There's been a lot of online oohs and ahs all over some amazing photos taken in recent days of the Northern Lights, also called the Aurora Borealis. Yep, we're going to talk about photos on the radio. Don't worry, we'll tell you in a moment where to see the pictures. The best spot for viewing the Northern Lights is typically up in northern Scandinavia. The source of the recent excitement is that now people further south were able to get in on the action. Ron Strathy is an amateur photographer who lives on the Isle of Man, located in the Irish Sea between England and Ireland. Ron, how unusual is it to see the Northern Lights at your latitude?
It's fairly unusual. If we're fortunate, we might get three or four half-decent shows a year, but more often than not, you'll go out and you'll spend some time looking for them and you don't see anything. So it was a special evening to see them on Sunday there, yeah.
So from my fast reading on the subject, auroras happen because the sun is pumping gaseous particles into space, and when those particles reach magnetic fields at the north and south poles, they mix with the Earth's own atmospheric gases, and that's when really dazzling things happen. For someone who has not seen the Northern Lights before in person, describe them, what you saw and the range of colors that emerge in the sky.
Yeah, your scientific description is about the same level as mine. The electrons in the solar wind and the electrons there colliding with atoms in the Earth's atmosphere, and especially around the north and south pole. We're very fortunate on Sunday there because you don't often get a lot of the reds showing, but the red shows when the particles hit the oxygen that's very high up in the atmosphere, about over 150 miles up. And red's not that easy for the human eye to pick up. It picks up the green you see in auroras more often than that. So it was different that way. And the reds weren't visible at our latitudes with the naked eye. It was sitting on the cameras, people's cameras, to manage to pick it up. And you could pick it up with your mobile, or you can pick it up with a sophisticated SLR camera. So, yeah.
So does that mean the colors that we see in the pictures are really there, or it's just kind of something that's interpreted by the camera?
The atmospheric reaction and the hitting of the molecules, that's up there and it's happening, but it's generally not visible to the naked eye at these latitudes where we are. You may see the reds with the naked eye, say in Scandinavia and further north, but here it's only picked up by the camera rather than the naked eye. So I was quite amazed when I went out with the camera and set it up and I took the photograph. I just couldn't believe how red it was, because when you looked up in the sky, you didn't really see anything of the red.
Wow. It must have been really captivating. Were you just kind of like going back and forth between the screen on your camera and seeing this amazing sky and then going back to the camera again?
Yeah, well, first of all, I thought there's something wrong with the camera because I've never seen it this red before. But after taking a few photographs in different settings, I convinced myself, yes, it was happening. And there were other people who I know were picking up the same type of photographs on the island. So I wasn't mistaken. It was just one of these, once every how many years, happenings.
Yeah. How long were you out there? How many frames did you capture?
I didn't get too excessive. I only took about 100 or so, and took some here, then moved further up the island to get some nice shots over. We've got an old Viking castle built with Vikings, and the nice aurora over that was a bit special as well.
Yeah, wow. For a photographer like yourself, Ron, the night sky can be kind of tough to capture. The scale is huge, but also you've got to account for a lack of light. Is the night sky a favorite subject for you as a photographer, and why do you like that challenge?
It is. It's one which I took up a few years ago. Where we live in the Isle of Man, we're very fortunate because being in the middle of the Irish Sea, our light pollution is not too bad at all. We've got 26 official dark sky sites, so step outside of our front door in an evening and see the Milky Way going across the sky, so we're very fortunate.
Well, I hope you get many, many more. Ron Strathy is an amateur photographer who lives on the Isle of Man. Ron, thanks for being with us.
No problem. Glad to be in touch. Thank you.
Those Aurora photos, I promised you, they are on our Twitter feed. Incredible shots by Ron Strathy. Our Twitter handle is @TheWorld. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World.
Yes!
That is a Russian tank being targeted by Ukrainian troops. Anti-tank weapons such as the American-made Javelin were among the first lethal military aid supplied to Ukraine. There's also the Stinger. It's a shoulder-fired missile that can take down enemy aircraft. Both the Stinger and the Javelin come from U.S. military stockpiles. Since last year, there's been concern that ammunition for these and other weapons is being used up in Ukraine faster than it can be produced. Mark Kansian is a retired U.S. Marine colonel, now a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Mark, howitzers also became part of Ukraine's arsenal. When you look at the full array of U.S.-supplied weapons, how important are they on the battlefield at this point in the war?
Well, the first thing is that the weapons that the United States and others are providing are absolutely critical for Ukraine's resistance. Without this flow of weapons and munitions, Ukraine's defenses would wither in 2 or 3 weeks.
There is this concern that Ukraine is using up ammunition for these weapons faster than it can be supplied. Is that concern legit?
It is. You have to be careful because there are certain areas where U.S. stocks and production capabilities are adequate. But it's a couple of very important items where the inventories have been getting low and where production is not keeping up with demand. Things like Javelin, like Stinger, like 155 millimeter ammunition.
Mark, on the production side, can the U.S. make this ammunition fast enough for use in Ukraine?
It can, but it takes several years for production to increase. To give you a sense on artillery ammunition, the United States has been producing about 15,000 rounds a year. They're bumping that up, but the Ukrainians right now are using 90,000 a month. So even at the higher level, it will only supply about half of Ukraine's needs.
So how deep are reserves of the ammunition for these weapons, either in Ukraine, the U.S., or partner countries? Are there stockpiles that can be tapped?
Well, for some items like Javelin, like Stinger, like 155 millimeter ammunition, the answer is no. We have sent to Ukraine the amounts that we are comfortable with, the level of risk that we're comfortable with, given that the United States has other requirements, global requirements, other war plans that has to be ready to execute.
So it sounds like you're saying there is a limit to what the U.S. can supply for all sorts of reasons.
I mean, there is a limit, but we also have to keep in mind that there are substitutions available and there are foreign sources that we can tap into and are tapping into. So we're not going to get into the position where Ukraine runs out of weapons and ammunition, but we are going to have to change over time what we give them and what we do with our own stocks and production.
Mark, how does Washington think about the need to send weapons to Ukraine and at the same time keeping its own inventory of weapons up to snuff in the event the U.S. has to engage directly in some future conflict with an adversary?
The Javelins, I think, are a good example. We sent Ukraine probably 40% of our Javelin inventory, and that was the level at which DOD was willing to accept risk, but not go below that. Other war plans, you know, the Pentagon, of course, hasn't said which war plans would be an issue, but you can imagine North Korea, for example. It's a ground war there, would require a lot of these same kinds of munitions, maybe the Baltic countries and defending them also. So those are the kinds of eventualities the United States is holding inventories back to be able to deal with.
Hmm. Mark Kansian is a senior advisor with the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, helping us understand the availability of ammunition for Ukraine in its fight against Russia. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me on the show.
President Biden stood in Kyiv last week and said to the people of Ukraine that the world stands with you. It's not entirely accurate. At the United Nations, 141 countries voted to condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine last Friday. 7 nations voted no, and perhaps more importantly, 32 abstained, many of them countries in Africa. While the continent has been impacted by wheat and fertilizer shortages from the war, many governments there have tried to remain neutral. They see the war as a European problem. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi tells us more.
Last year, when Russian President Vladimir Putin announced parts of eastern Ukraine were now independent, one of the strongest rebukes came from Martin Kimani, then Kenya's ambassador to the United Nations.
Kenya is gravely concerned by the announcement made by the Russian Federation to recognize Donetsk and Luhansk regions of Ukraine as independent states.
Ukraine's territorial integrity and sovereignty had been breached, he said. Kimani went on to compare the insecurity in these areas of Ukraine that border Russia to Africa's own history of border disputes.
Today, across the border of every single African country, live our countrymen with whom we share deep historical, cultural, and linguistic bonds. At independence, had we chosen to pursue states on the basis of ethnic, racial or religious homogeneity, we would still be waging bloody wars these many decades later.
Diplomacy, not force, is the only solution to this conflict, he said. At the time, Kimani's speech got a lot of attention globally. Olayinka Jala, a lecturer at Leeds Beckett University in Britain, was one of those who took notice.
It shows that Africa is more and more significant at the international stage when we look at the reception from all around the world.
Since that speech, however, there has been a lot more attention on how other African countries have reacted to the war, especially those who have opted to stay neutral.
The initial reaction of African countries is not to get embroiled in another long conflict. And some people were not happy with that because some people felt if you are not aligning with the West, that means you are actually in support of the conflict.
Ajala says you can't lump 54 African countries into one basket. Each one has different foreign policy goals that should be respected. Namibia, for example, has non-alignment enshrined in its constitution. Others have growing trade, economic, and military ties with Russia.
Many African countries depend on Russia for fertilizers, for wheat, for oil, for different things like that. So many of them strategically found it very difficult to just turn their backs on their ally.
He adds that many African countries see the war in Ukraine as a European conflict that needs to be resolved internally. The experiences of African students in Ukraine may have also informed their views, he says. Last year, videos on social media showed African students being prevented from fleeing Ukraine. 27-year-old Zimbabwean student Corinne Skye experienced this firsthand. She tells me how she and her husband were forced to leave their vehicle at the Ukraine-Romania border and told to stand in a line outside, in the cold, with mostly black and brown people.
We were last. They were going to make sure that the Ukrainian people were safe, and then they would allow us, after days actually, well at this point it was 4 days, and it was so heartbreaking.
She says that experience of racism left a bad taste in her mouth. A year later, she and other African students who fled Ukraine are really struggling, while Ukrainians have been welcomed by other countries and helped to start over.
We lost everything and nobody cares. Yet, when we see our counterparts, like the people that we left with, our neighbors, they've been accommodated and the world has opened their arms to them.
Skye tells me most of the African students haven't been given opportunities to continue their education, and some have been deported from Europe. But she said despite the racism she experienced while fleeing Ukraine, she still says African countries, including Zimbabwe, where she's from, should take a stronger stand against Russia. War is wrong, she says. For The World, I'm Halima Kakandi in Lagos, Nigeria.
We will be right back. You're listening to The World. In Iran, mysterious poisonings. Hundreds of girls have been exposed to toxic gases, making them sick, raising suspicions about who's behind it.
With so much control of that society, it's really hard to think that so many attacks could happen without anyone within the regime aware of it.
And a Ukrainian rock star brings comfort to the front lines ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Perhaps no tropical location on Earth is more inhospitable to human life than the Darien Gap, a mountainous rainforest situated between Colombia and Panama. Despite the dangers, at least 60,000 miners are expected to trek north, taking the 66-mile trail through the gap this year in pursuit of a better life. That's according to a new report from UNICEF. Sandy Blanchet is with UNICEF Panama and joins us from Panama City. The journey across the Darien Gap is extremely dangerous, and not everyone makes it through alive. Set the scene for us, Sandy. What makes the Darien Gap so treacherous?
Well, we have to imagine a huge jungle. It's actually a beautiful place. It's a national park in Panama. It's known for its biodiversity. It's very wild, and biodiversity means, you know, you can find jaguars, snakes, monkeys, mangroves, huge trees. As you said, it's mountainous, so it's not flat at all. It's quite treacherous if you try to walk through it. There are very wild rivers. During the rainy season, the rivers can overflow with very violent currents. It's quasi impenetrable, to be honest. And I say quasi because there are people who are crossing it.
Right. I mean, despite the hazards, so many people are willing to make this dangerous journey, and many parents are willing to send their children into this dense forest. Why is that?
Parents really believe that at home, wherever home is, there is no hope of a good life for their children. Parents, no matter where they are, who they are driven by the desire to offer a better life to their children. They are taking this travel, this trip also through this dangerous jungle, because in some cases they are not well informed. We have to imagine that the social networks are widely used nowadays to promote, in some cases, what is presented as a tourism package to cross the jungle. Like you would, you know, I don't know, go to a national park in the US and camp there for a few days. And so there is a lot of misinformation.
And just briefly, what countries are people coming from and children coming from who go through the Darien Gap?
I think what is very incredible is that we have more than 70 nationalities. There are people coming, of course, from the region, from South America, but we also see people coming from China, India, Afghanistan, Congo, Ghana. So there are also all these international routes that are being developed by what we need to call criminal networks, who are taking a lot of money from people to bring them to South America and then through the Darien Jungle.
So let's get into this report from UNICEF. How is your organization able to predict that so many people, a cohort as specific as 60,000 minors in this particular part of the world, the Darien Gap, will move through there by the end of this year? What was the methodology?
First, I have to say it's an estimate. Nobody can say with certainty how many people will come and will go through the Darien Jungle and Panama, simply because we know from experience that a single factor, a single change, for example, in the US or in Haiti or in other places, can have bigger repercussions on the flow of migrants and refugees. So we took the data from the past 10 years and we looked at different scenario and different options. The medium scenario, which is also based on the trend this year, is that we would have approximately 300,000 people crossing, including 20% children.
For the children who do make it through the Darien Gap, what's waiting for them on the other side in Panama?
You see these traditional canoes, these dugout boats, very long, very narrow, very close to the surface of water, with 20, 25 people in them, adults, children, babies. They arrive, you know, to some kind of a natural beach in the Darien, and they staggered to the reception center, where they are seen by the authorities, and there is some kind of a triage happening. Those who have funding, who have money with them, they can continue to take a bus to cross Panama. Some of them are too sick, they are wounded, they cannot continue. So they need to have immediate attention. So they get access to services offered by the government and also UN agencies and NGOs. And some of them do not have the money to continue. They need to call their family back home or their family in the US or in Canada to get some money wired so they can take the bus.
I was going to ask, I mean, given the level of misinformation and disinformation you talked about earlier about the path of migration before these people leave their home countries, does UNICEF in Panama try to discourage people from moving further north once they get to Panama?
We inform them of what awaits them. All we can do in every country is to share with them accurate information about what awaits them. It is their decision. We are not going to put them in camps or you know, before they come to Panama, we wish they would not start the journey through the Darien Jungle because it's a very dangerous one. So even in Colombia, we talk to them to share accurate information.
I mean, as you said, 60,000 minors crossing the Darien Gap in 2023. That's an estimate. But I mean, needless to say, one child crossing the Darien Gap alone is still too many. Ultimately, what is the solution to bringing that number down?
I think there are numbers of solutions. One is we need to make sure that in the countries of origin, children have opportunities to grow up safe, protected from violence, healthy, and educated. The second solution is to offer legal pathways to migrate in richer countries. We saw it when in October 2022, when the US announced a new program offering visas to people from Venezuela if they would migrate legally, meaning they could not have access to the visa program if they went through the Darien Jungle. The number of Venezuelans crossing the Darien Jungle went from 2,500 a day to 50 a day. A third one is we need to combat the criminality, the criminal groups that are taking advantage of the despair of families and of parents, of adolescents, and who are organizing these trips, promising some kind of a tourist package. We have to combat disinformation and make sure that law enforcement agencies are working together.
Sandy Blanchet is with UNICEF in Panama. We were discussing a new projection estimating that more than 60,000 minors are set to cross the Darien Gap this year. Sandy joined us from Panama City. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Here's something for your nose to consider. What does art smell like? An art history project funded by the European Union is taking that on by recreating aromas that are tied to works of art as part of an effort to preserve and maintain historical smells that have fallen out of daily life. The world's Duri Bascaran followed her nose to the town of Ulm in southern Germany, where an art museum is trying out olfactory tourism.
In a gallery at the Museum Ulm, tour guide Florence Rieker asks a crowd to gather around a small 16th century painting of a man praying, the Portrait of Eitel Besserer by Martin Schaffner. Rieker draws attention to a small silver pomander attached to the man's rosary. In the 1500s, these delicate ornamental balls were filled with spices and fragrant resins, once believed to protect you from disease. To demonstrate, Rieker pulls out a container of little plastic diffuser vials. A few pumps is all it takes to release a spray of fragrance, carefully designed to match this painting. Within moments, the air is perfumed with notes of pine and winter spices. It's somehow fresh and warm at the same time. And according to Lizzie Marks, an art historian who helped design this scent, it could be close to what Eitel Besserer actually smelled when he sat for this portrait all the way back in the year 1516.
What you find is in medical treatises and also household manuals that were printed in the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries, they have recipes for pomanders.
To create this scent, Marks tracked down a 16th century pomander recipe and passed it along to a perfumer.
Nutmeg, cloves, rosemary, cinnamon, rose. And then there are three animalic ingredients. They're ambergris, civet, and musk.
Ambergris is a waxy, earthy-smelling substance secreted by sperm whales. Civet, the secretions of a small nocturnal mammal, would have been imported from Ethiopia. These ingredients illustrate Ulm's historical prominence as a wealthy trade center, but they also represent the violence of colonialism and the exploitation of people who do not appear in the painting.
So then there's this whole new dimension that's given to the painting, because you're able to be transported back to the 16th century when this work of art was painted.
This project, called Odoropa, is part of an effort to preserve the smellscapes that are no longer a part of daily life, but also a chance to challenge the assumption that the past was, well, stinky.
Everything is relative. The way in which I challenge that is saying, well, what if we had people from the 17th century come to us in the present day and visit us? I think they would be absolutely appalled by the smell of pollution within cities.
The scents of the Ulm Museum's olfactory tour are designed to make you think about that. As you stand before an oil painting of a 17th century pleasure garden nestled in fortified city walls, tour guide Florence Rieker sprays a deep floral scent with hints of berry and salty sea air. For this modern three-dimensional still life by Daniel Sperry, a top-down view of the remains of a steak dinner are glued to the wall.
So good. Yeah.
The scent Rieker shares here evokes ash and rot. There's also a hint of spilled red wine and dull, forgotten flowers.
Und Sie sehen natürlich, dass hier etwas in der Hand hat.
Rieker says there's no reason for art to be only something you experience with your eyes. Smell is a dimension that is connected directly to the limbic system, she says, which is our most immediate sense. It's connected directly to our emotions and our feelings, says Rieker. And in that way, it's also part of the foundation of our memories. For the world, I'm Duri Bascaran in Ulm, Germany.
In Ukraine, Sviatoslav Vakarchuk is a household name, possibly the country's biggest rock star, like the Ukrainian Bruce Springsteen or Bono. He's also politically active, visiting troops on the front lines and raising money for Ukraine's war effort. Vakarchuk says the Beatles were his first musical inspiration when he was a kid in the 80s. By 1999, he himself was recording hit songs with his band Okean Elzy.
You know, we never woke up famous overnight, you know? So it was like little by little.
Now, after countless hits and a PhD in theoretical physics, Vakarchuk has focused his music and his political activism on supporting Ukraine and its armed forces.
On February 24th, in early morning, I was in my house, not far from Kyiv. I vividly remember my feelings and the whole day. In the morning, I couldn't sleep really well, so I woke up really early from some anxiety. I heard this, you know, blows on the right of me. I think it was one of these first initial attacks on Ukrainian military infrastructure. My family was out already, so I just started helping other people to get out of Kyiv. And then we understood that the initial attack didn't succeed, and we understood that now it will be a real front line in the war. We got together and we went to the east, to these hotspots, cities like Kharkiv, Zaporizhia, and others, and started supporting people, pumping up the mood and everything else. And we're still doing it. You need to act the most effective way to win. I think that my, let's say, competitive advantage, I don't know, my superpower, right, is to inspire people. So that's something I've been doing for so many years, and I think we gained some success in the field. For me, personally, it's just unjust that so many boys and girls now are suffering in the trenches and risking their life, and I will be sitting in a relatively safe place. I treat it just to go there and to be with them and to share this kind of risk, and it gives them some rest, emotional rest, that gives them some understanding that the whole country is behind them, so it works. The sun in a shine. So I performed this song Choven, or the boat, in Kherson near Antonivsky Bridge, which was destroyed by Russians. This song is about Ukraine, and it literally describes the country on the both sides of the Dnipro River, left bank and right bank. This is a very symbolic song, and I wanted to sing it there near this bridge that actually now is destroyed, but the spiritual bridge is impossible to destroy by enemy, so there was about this. So we recorded a cover of a famous song, You Are So Beautiful. We spelled it like UA So Beautiful, because UA, it's a sign of Ukraine.
You are so beautiful. To me.
Can't you see? I just like this song. I remember here in Kyiv being on Joe Cocker when he performed it, and it's one of my favorite songs of mine. And I dedicate it to my country, because for me, this is the most beautiful country in the world. Even destroyed by Russians, even torn by the war, it's still number one for me.
You bring sad joy and happiness.
I'm trying to be, you know, a little bit Buddhist during this year, to focus on your moment. Because if you try reflect on everything that we've been through this year, I can tell you it's still a one long day that started on the 24th and still haven't been over. And so I'm trying to live in the moment and I'm trying to act the way that makes victory closer. This is it.
You pray like a dream. You got a light that shines in the night.
Ukrainian rock star and political activist Vyacheslav Vakarchuk there with his take on Joe Cocker's You Are So Beautiful. Our story was produced by The World's Daniel Hoffman.
You are so beautiful.
Since late November, an estimated 900 schoolgirls in Iran have been poisoned by what appears to be a toxic gas. They've experienced respiratory problems, nausea, dizziness, and fatigue. Cases were first reported in girls' schools in and around the holy city of Qom, about 90 miles south of Tehran. There have also been incidents in cities in northern and western parts of the country. Iranian authorities initially dismissed the cases, but now describe them as intentional attacks by religious groups using, quote, mild poisons. Hadi Gaemi heads up the Center for Human Rights in Iran, which is based in New York. He says he has learned that one schoolgirl exposed to the poisonous gas has died.
The latest news we have confirmed is that one girl in the city of Qom has died. Her name is Fatemeh Rezai. It turns out that her father actually works for very high-level clerics in the regime. He's a driver. And the family been under intense pressure to declare it as natural death due to pre-existing conditions and liver problems from before. But we've talked to people close to the family who have said she died because of this recent wave of poisoning.
What do we know about what these girls have been poisoned with?
Yesterday, we learned through the Public Health Committee of the Parliament that at least some of the poisonous gas is nitrogen gas. That is what their findings have indicated. We're not sure if this is through an investigation of all the cases or just in certain locations. But there is no question that there's an attack going on with the intention of closing down girls' schools throughout the country.
Right. On Sunday, that's what an Iranian deputy minister said. The poisoning was intentional and suggested that the people behind it were trying to shut down education for girls. What is your reaction to that explanation?
Iran is a country very tightly controlled in every aspect of life by intelligence security forces. We must note that these intelligence security agencies have a track record of carrying out covert operations against dissidents throughout the country over the years. So it's really hard to believe that a super fanatical religious group now is targeting girls' schools. I'm extremely worried that this is actually happening deep within the regime as a punishment of the girls who were so active the last 4 months in their schools, especially turning them into protest platforms.
Well, that is your fear, and we know the government has already put activists to death, but what reasons do you have to believe that the government may somehow be behind these poisonings, and how hard would it be to answer that?
Because they, again, are very aware of everything goes in the society. It's really hard to think that an organized group would have so much capabilities to target so many schools and inject poisonous gas into their environment. Now, I must add that there are many multiple centers of power in Iran, and it could very well be that some of them have the autonomy to make the decision to carry out such attacks. But there's no single person in charge here, and the very widespread nature of security and intelligence forces and their history makes me believe they must be implicated, given how they can discover almost every other action happening within the society.
Do we even know if any of the girls who were poisoned were involved in protests over the past 5-6 months?
It's very clear that this is randomly targeting, given the number of cities and institutions involved, not specific protesters. And note that this is primarily happening to girls' schools. So I think it's a wholesale message to this generation of Iranian girls that they better stay out of politics or their lives will be in danger.
Just to be clear, though, you do not have firm evidence yet that the Iranian government is involved in any way in the poisonings.
No, but in a country such a closed society, they're never going to allow their own judiciary to investigate independently. I'm just saying that with so much control of that society, it's really hard to think that so many attacks could happen without anyone within the regime intelligence services aware of it.
How was this all first discovered? Like, did girls at the very school start feeling sick at school? Or what do we know?
Actually, the part that's not being mentioned is, again, early on during the protests, we had several university campuses reporting poisoning in their dining halls. That also happened randomly and throughout the country. So I wonder what is the relationship. That became public very quickly because college students were very active on social media during the protests. With the girls' school, we have been hearing of them, but it mostly been coming from local communities that have suffered. And then it reached a point where the government had to look into it and admit it.
Hadi Gaemi is the executive director of the Center for Human Rights in Iran, based in New York. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco. Pleasure talking to you.
Up until today, I thought the only people who could survive in nature on ketchup were two thugs lost in the Pine Barrens of New Jersey.
They clean?
I don't know. They were in the bag. They were a little halfway frozen.
Pauly and Christopher in that unforgettable episode of The Sopranos, surviving on Tic Tacs and packets of ketchup in the woods. In real life, though, it was a bottle of Heinz that helped one man from the island of Dominica survive, being lost in the Caribbean Sea for 24 days. Station KDKA in Pittsburgh, the proud home of Heinz, explained the ordeal of 47-year-old Elvis Francois.
Now, back in January, he was repairing his boat when he was swept out to sea. For more than 3 weeks, he drifted deeper and deeper into the ocean where he was.
He was eventually rescued by a Colombian Navy patrol plane. But the part of his story that went viral? The ketchup. Heinz loved the story and wanted to buy Elvis Francois a new boat, except it was hard to track him down. Local media outlet Imo News in Dominica did, though.
Good afternoon, Elvis.
Hello, good day.
How are you?
I'm okay.
It's always a pleasure to see you alive after such an ordeal at sea. So, tell us about Elvis.
Well, I would say quite a mysterious person.
Mysterious, he says, and apparently soft-spoken, but appreciative of that bottle of ketchup.
You see, everything happens for a reason. You have the ketchup. The ketchup is very... It has vitamins.
Elvis Francois recently had an online meeting with Heinz from his home in Dominica and is now the owner of a new boat, courtesy of the ketchup company. That is our show on this Wednesday. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Be safe, stay strong, and thanks as always for listening.
668. That's how many people donated to the World during the fall fundraising campaign. Those 668 helped us surpass our goal of $67,000. And we want to thank some of those incredible donors right now. Jerry Goodspeed Gross, Sylvia Wong, Brian Connolly, Sandy Guess, Leslie Johnson, Kyle Anderson, Blaise Tobia and Virginia Maximovich, Bill and Kathleen Corcoran, Kyoko Maruyama, Ellen Trump. And thank you to not only the 668 donors, but to all of our listeners. We couldn't have done it without you.